the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Well, there's nothing like taking a vacation, and there's nothing like travel. Most individuals that get into retirement, that's probably where they spend a lot of their time and expenditures, that first phase of their retirement. Well, you may not realize it, but one of the most inexpensive ways to travel is owning your RV. Joining us on the program today is Mark and Julie Bennett. They are the proprietors of the website RV Love and also the author of Living the RV Life, Your Ultimate Guide to the Life on the Road. And Mark and Julie, we had such a response the last time we had you on the program. What I really wanted to do today, because I'm actually thinking of buying an RV, is talk about the different RVs, the different classes of RVs, and when they're appropriate. In other words, if I'm going out shopping for an RV, I mean, you've got these different kinds of coaches. You got A class, B, C, you've got fifth wheelers, you've got toy haulers. I mean, how do I know where to go? And I thought maybe the first place we would start is I'm looking for an RV. Let's talk about the different classes of RVs, what they are, and where they might be more appropriate for somebody that's looking for one. So let's begin.
Sure. Sounds great. And thanks so much for having us on, Jim. We've really enjoyed our last chat with you, and we're excited to be joining you again.
Yeah, it's really great to be here.
But as far as the different kinds of classes, I think the first way to keep it straight is to think about there's two different main classes in that there's motorized and there's towable. So towable, you'd need something else to be able to tow it, obviously, and motorized, it can move itself down the road. And
within, no, you do need a driver.
Yeah, well, they are starting with some of those guided cruise controls and stuff. But as far as the motorized kinds, there's Class A, Class B, Class C, and then there's some subclasses that are a B plus and Super C, but we'll go through those briefly. Class A are the ones that look like big buses, and very blocky shape, but and very large, generally at least 30 feet, sometimes up to 45 feet. They come in gas-powered or diesel-powered, and the big diesels can be very big, heavy vehicles, 45,000 pounds, and they are intimidating to people, but if you take a driving course, you'll be surprised at how easily maneuverable they can be. A Class B is a far smaller RV. It's usually based on a van chassis, that looks, to the untrained eye, might just look like a cargo van or something like that, but they're highly maneuverable, much better in fuel economy, and what's nice about those is they're very nimble for your travel style. A Class C is also based on a van chassis usually, but also has a larger, wider body and then usually an over-the-cab sleeping area.
And the Class Cs are the ones you'll commonly see as RV rentals out on the road. You know, you'll see them out in popular touristy areas and national parks, and you might see Cruise America or Road Bear RV. They're probably the most common type of RV that you'll see out there, really.
Yeah, those are, I agree, the most commonly seen type. And then there's the Super Cs, which are larger versions of those, often built on heavy truck chassis, like semi-chassis. And also truck campers, which are a camper that would go into the bed of a traditional pickup truck. And we sometimes jokingly call those Class Vs because they're very versatile in that some people like to have a modular approach to their travel. They would have that, and they might have a boat, or they might have a trailer they tow with other toys. So, as far as towables, which is the other major category.
Yeah, I was just going to go to towables because you have things like a fifth wheel, or you have like the Airstream travel trailer.
Yeah.
So let's talk about those two.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, fifth wheel is very popular for people who are doing extended stay travel, or because the fifth wheel gets its name because of the hitch type, in that the hitch mounts to the bed of a truck instead of behind a towing vehicle. They're usually much larger. They often look like they completely dwarf the truck that pulls them, but they're very homey, very livable. The other type of trailer, a travel trailer, Airstream is a type of travel trailer, which would pull from the rear of the vehicle, and much lighter and smaller, and also not nearly as tall, and can therefore be towed by a much larger variety of vehicles.
And the towables too, like the travel trailers, that's often where a lot of people get started with an RV, as a family way to get away and have weekends and vacations, whether they start with a a pop-up is actually really commonplace to start, but travel trailers, you'll see a lot of these in people's backyards or even RV storage areas around the country. And that's usually because it's more affordable and more common to be able to start with a travel trailer. And usually once people start to move up, then they might start looking at a fifth wheel or a motorized if they're changing their mode of travel.
Yeah, and you'll see in the industry wide, actually, towables are about 85% of all RVs. The motorized ones are the remaining 15, of course, and the majority of those would be the Class C and smaller RVs. Only a small percentage are the Class A's, but for people who do extended RV travel, they become a much higher percentage of that population.
You know, that's something that now that I'm looking for an RV, I become very cognizant when I'm driving on the freeway. You know, I'm looking and I'm seeing the fifth wheelers, I'm seeing the towables, and so I notice them more. Let me ask you this. So we talked about different kinds, whether you're towable, you have your A, B, and your C. How does one know what one needs? I've heard that one of the mistakes people make, they either get something too small or they get something too big. And I mean, I have to admit, the first time I went into an RV dealership and I looked at an A, you know, something the size of a bus on a road, it was intimidating because you get in there and you think, oh my goodness, how do I drive this thing? Because unlike those of us that drive cars day to day, you don't have a rear view mirror and you're almost like a truck driver. You're totally dependent on those side view mirrors.
That's absolutely true, Jim. And in chapter 3 of our book, it's called Finding Your Home on Wheels. That is all about choosing the right RV setup for you and helping you go through that process and understand in more detail. We touched on the different kinds of RVs just a few minutes ago, but we got a lot more depth in that and taking people through the questions and the process that they need to go through to really narrow down to what one is going to be right for them. But
yeah, because I think a lot of it just depends on how you intend to use it. I mean, I'll give you a couple examples. If you're a solo traveler and you're still keeping a home base, you're going to be traveling for a few weeks or maybe a couple months at a time, and your primary focus is exploring and traveling, a smaller RV like a Class B would probably be a great fit, or Class C. Now, on the other hand, if you're going to be doing more seasonal or full-time or longer stays, and especially if you're working from the RV, then something like a fifth wheel or a larger Class A motorhome makes a lot more sense. But as far as your question about the intimidation of the driving, it's interesting that you'll see a lot of the little old man kind of jumping out of his giant Class A, and it's because they're so planted with their air suspension and they're being heavyweight. They're actually, once you get used to maneuvering it, they're actually very comfortable and very easy to drive.
And of course, there are RV driving schools all around the country. And that's something that we really recommend people consider when they're buying an RV, because it's really different whether you're towing or driving a big motorized. You know, it might seem expensive at first, spending, $600 or something like that for a couple of days driving training. But when you think about how much you're spending on your RV, and what literally your life is riding on that thing. And often if it's full-time living as it is for us, our entire lives, our home, everything's riding on that. So spending the money on having the comfort and the confidence and the skills to be able to drive any kind of RV or tow or back or park an RV is really valuable. But we had that question too, Jim, when we were starting. We were like, do we go with a big Class A motorhome, which is very appealing, or do we go with a fifth wheel because it can be so homey? And it was, you know, a really good way to be able to narrow that down was looking in our garage.
Right, exactly. That's a great place to start. And when we looked in our garage, we saw we had two sporty cars, and we loved being enthusiast drivers. And so we knew that was important to us, whereas someone else might be used to driving a large pickup truck and may already even own that. And owning the truck is a big part of the expense of having a towable RV, is the vehicle that tows it, because some of those trucks can cost $80,000 for a new one that has enough capacity to tow those. But if you're, and it also, when you have a towable, that truck becomes your vehicle that you do your running around in and your errands and your exploring. So you need to be comfortable driving that frequently. Whereas if you tow a smaller car behind a motorhome, you have that much smaller vehicle to maneuver.
And that was a big part of our decision making, was because we do like to drive little sporty cars. We started with a Mini Cooper convertible. We wanted to go and drive, you know, Highway 1 in California and do Kirby Mountain Drive. And that was more important to us than having a big truck driving down the road, because I'm pretty small. I'm under 5 feet tall. So it was definitely a bit intimidating for me, and not fun for me to think about driving a big truck around, going to the grocery store, and some of those big dualies are actually so wide it can be difficult to park them or even take some narrow roads. So, you know, I think most people would have an idea of what kind of a driver they are, you know, if you prefer big or small vehicles. A lot of people in Texas probably like those big trucks. That's what we found. Everything's bigger in Texas.
Let me ask you this. You talk about, you know, you guys like driving sport cars, so you tow your sport car. One of the salesmen in an RV dealership told me he had a couple that didn't want to tow a car, so what they got was a Lyft, and they got like a Honda scooter in bicycles. So basically, if they just wanted to putz around, they could get around on this scooter or a Vespa. And then the other thing is, if you're going to be in a place for, I don't know, let's say you're going to be there a couple of weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, you could actually rent a car rather than tow one, or you can Uber if you're in a major city.
Yeah, and I love that. And I recommend it to people a lot, especially ones that are traveling in smaller RVs. And especially with the newer electric bikes, they're so much lighter weight than even a scooter, and they have big range. They can sometimes go 30 miles. So you can do a lot of local exploration with an electric bike, and they're lightweight, so they don't change the handling dynamics by putting some of these larger motorcycle lifts that you see people put on some of their RVs.
We do see that a lot.
But we do see those, yeah. Computers. And I love the idea of doing rental cars and Ubers and stuff like that when you're situated in a city as well, because there is a lot of versatility, a lot of options for people to do local travel with those other services.
And it can be a lot more cost effective, Jim, because setting your car up to tow it flat down, bore down, or flat towing, or setting it up on a tow dolly, which is what we started out with, and now we tow bore down. Neither of those are terribly, you know, inexpensive. The tow dolly is the less expensive option, but some people just don't want to be bothered with that hassle. And so, especially if you're someone who likes to, you know, be in areas where you're not too far away, or you can drop into an enterprise rent-a-car and book that, or if you're in a more urban area, even some of those places that have bike shares too. I mean, we've even seen people do that. There's some of those bike share programs, but they're all great options for people to not feel like they have to tow a car with them, but still have the option to be able to get around and not feel like they have to take their RV with them. And I love that creative thinking about different ways to do it. And honestly, I mean, of all the hundreds, if not thousands of people we've met out there, RV, I don't think any two people to do it exactly the same. Everyone's got such a different variety of their RV and their setup and their tow vehicle or their toys or their method of getting around. And I love it. I love seeing people just thinking creatively and differently about how they can create a setup that works well for them, not just doing what everyone else does, but really questioning what's important to me, what do I need, how do I like to travel and explore, and coming up with a solution that fits that. And there really is something for everyone.
When you're looking for an RV, whether it's A, B, or C, are there critical things that you think that are very important? Like one of the things that I think of, if I'm going to be in an RV, and this comes from just my experience in boating, I want to be comfortable. So, you know, you need a dinette where you can eat dinner, but also some kind of lounging chairs if you just want to sit and watch TV or read a book at night. And some people work on the road, like, you know, I'm connected to the stock market. So I would want some kind of desk arrangement or dinette where I could put up my laptops, Wi-Fi, keep track of what's going on in the markets. Are there anything that you think in your experience that is very critical that be part of any RV that you're looking at?
Yeah, and I think that's a great question, Jim. And it's something I like to joke about is, you know, in real estate market, people always say, oh, it's all about location, location, location. But in RVs, you get to change your location all the time. So it's really about the livability, the floor plan, and the layout of it. But also being able to think a little bit outside of the box with it. Like our first RV that we bought, it had what's called a bunkhouse. It was for a family with bunk beds. But we bought that RV with the intention of converting that bunkhouse into an office. And so there could be a dedicated office space. So, and also a lot of RVs, you know, the TV might not be in front of the couch and you're turning your head constantly with the sides. So if you're often watch a lot of TV, make sure that it's set up in a way that really fits your lifestyle.
And a lot of RVs these days, Jim, come with little desks or workspaces. A lot of people, of course, will work from the dinette, but that impacts your living and your eating space. But we're finding more and more RVs, and now manufacturers are thinking about that people are working from the road, or at least doing some emails or catching up or research or social media or booking your campground, and you need a comfortable place to do that. But another thing is the kitchen. You know, if you cook a lot in your RV, make sure that the kitchen has enough counter space for food prep, because sometimes that's you go into these RVs and they'll have sink covers where, you know, they're nice Corian covers that cover the sink, and it looks like the illusion is that there's a lot of counter space. So when you take those sink covers off, and I don't know about other people out there, but we never put our sink covers on the sink. Mm-hmm. We always leave them off. And so then that can really impact the amount of space you have to not only prepare food, but what do you do with your dirty dishes afterward before you get a chance to wash them? And some of them just don't really have a lot of space. But also things like, you know, if you are having guests, does it have a pull-out sofa bed, or does it have an over-cab bunk? And another thing to think about there is, I think it's easy for people to think that they want somewhere for guests to stay, but really ask yourself, honestly, how often will people realistically stay? Because we've seen people buy RVs thinking they need somewhere for the grandkids to sleep, but in reality, they hardly ever come and hardly spend any time. And so they've made a big decision around their floor plan and layout of their RV for something that, actually doesn't
happen. Happens a couple times a year.
Yeah, and then others use it a lot. But also in the bedroom, like if you're somebody who gets up during the night and you've got a bed that's up against a wall, not all RVs have beds that have space on either side. So think about access. If you get up during the night, can you easily access the bathroom without having to climb over your partner and wake them up? Because these are the simple things that are actually big things. And I think if you're just a weekender camper, that's not such a big deal. But the more time you're spending in your RV, the more important these things become. So we always recommend to people, when you're interested in an RV, take your time. Don't let a salesperson pressure you. Say, you know what, just leave me alone in here for a while. And it might be a couple of hours. Take your laptop, sit down in various parts of the RV, what's comfortable for you. Pretend you're watching television, pretend you're taking a shower, pretend you're using the bathroom, pretend you're sleeping and getting up or making the bed. Really take your time to get familiar with all that and how that works for you. And one really big thing, what I'm really big on, the toilet. I mean, it is amazing how often the placement of the toilet in RVs is not really factoring in that we need a little bit of room to move in there. So, you know, sit down and move your arms around. Because we are blown away by the number of RVs that, and I'm, as I said earlier, I'm small, I'm under 5 feet, that I even have trouble, you know, moving my arms around in. So that's a big one to really think about that, because that's important.
Okay, we've talked about the different classes of RVs from motorized to towables. Let's talk about engines, because they come in two varieties, either diesel or gasoline. Explain, in your opinion, the advantages or disadvantages of either.
Sure. And, you know, again, breaking that down to towable approach or motorized approach, in that a towable approach, the gasoline version of a truck and the diesel version of the truck are mostly the same truck. It's just changing the power plant and would give it more power, more engine braking and stuff like that. So the diesel generally gets better fuel economy and more power, especially for hills. When you're switching over to motorized, if it's a smaller motorized, like a Class B or Class C, you might just be looking at fuel economy. But if you're looking at a Class A and you're talking about gas versus diesel, they're very different animals. A gas coach is much lighter weight because it has less power. And so there's less, the chassis is not nearly as heavy weight. They usually don't have nearly as much cargo carry capacity. They don't have air suspension, so they're not as smooth and planted to ride. Whereas a diesel Class A coach are a very, very planted, very solid, and they have large power plants to be able to carry a lot of cargo, and you're able to do a lot more residential type finishes in that RV because of the extra capacity that it has. So it's not, when you're talking about diesel Class A coaches versus Class A gas, it's very different price point, but they're also very different types of RVs. Whereas the trucks, it's mostly just the power plant.
But the big difference on those two is the price, as Mark said, you know, gas is much less expensive. And our first motorhome, Class A motorhome, was a gas. And, you know, we just took it easy. We took it slow. And even though it did have some more limitations compared to the diesel we have now, it was also substantially less expensive, you know, to buy a similar RV of a similar age.
Yeah. So, and I think a big part of that decision-making would be how you travel. If you're going to be traveling very short distances and staying long periods of time, meaning that you're going to spend maybe 100 hours in the RV for every hour or two that you're driving it, it might not be worth the extra money you spend on a diesel. But if you're going to spend driving longer distances, or if you know those extra things really matter, then that becomes more worthwhile to make that upgrade.
And maintenance is cheaper and easier on a gas too, and more expensive on a diesel. But you know, it does become a price versus usage, and being able to justify what's the best fit for you.
Let's say you've reached a conclusion. You know the kind of RV that you're going to want to get. And let's just say, like in my case, I'm looking at an A. Let's talk about the advantages of buying something new versus used. There are some dealerships out there that have such a massive scale of inventory that they sell these things new for almost the price of a used one. So what's the advantages and disadvantages of buying new versus used? I know if I buy a car new, the minute I drive it off the lot, I've lost 20%. And let's not kid ourselves, an RV, no matter what you call it, is a depreciating asset.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I like that you've done research.
Yeah, I love that you've done your research. Yes, they are depreciating assets. And you are correct that right now there is an excess inventory on dealer lots for a lot of those types of RVs. And so they're often able to get them 20% off, and sometimes even 30 and even more percent off of MSRP. So very rarely, if ever, would you ever pay MSRP when you're looking at a new unit. One important thing I want to point out on buying new versus used is that the common misconception is that people are used to buying new cars, and new cars are very different from new RVs in that RVs are built mostly by hand in lower tech facilities, and therefore there's often more bugs to work out in a new RV than there is in a very well taken care of pre-owned RV. But it also, a secondary element is that depending on where you buy it, the dealership might do it. One dealership might do a much better job on what's called a PDI, a pre-delivery inspection, working through a lot of those bugs and therefore delivering a higher quality, more trouble-free unit than some dealer that, if you're only selling on price, they might do a quicker PDI and then leave more troubles for you as the owner. But I guess I just want to make sure that people point out that, you know, cars are built high-tech facilities, mostly automated and very reliable for years after buying a new one, whereas the new RV is a little bit different in that respect. There's definitely pros and cons to both. New, you can choose your colors, you can choose your styling, you know the entire history of it. But if a pre-owned one, if you're buying from the right person, you can have a really good history on it as well. Some people like new because they like the warranty, but RVs, again, unlike cars, usually only have a 1-year warranty.
Some are 2 years.
Some are 2 year, but you can get extended warranties on new or used RVs, usually third party through companies like wholesale warranties and stuff like that.
I don't know if this exists in RV parks or not, but I know that, for example, if you're into boating and you, let's say, join, like, for example, the San Diego Yacht Club, you have privileges with other yacht clubs around the country. So if I'm a member of San Diego, if I go up to Newport Beach or up to San Francisco, I have exchange privileges. Are there anything equivalent to that in RV land?
I've seen those RV yacht clubs. I've seen how some people want to have the ability to have their RV and a yacht in a club. But as far as memberships, you know, there's camping memberships that allow it.
Yeah. Not anything quite exactly like you're talking about there, Jim, whereas if you're a yacht club member, you can go to any club around the world, if I'm understanding that correctly, because never having been a boat owner, am I correct in understanding that from you?
Yeah. The other thing that really struck me, I was Googling luxury RV facilities, and I came across the top 15, and there was one in Indio that I took a look at. Oh, my goodness. I mean, it's got a 10,000 square foot clubhouse, tennis courts, pickle courts, pool, spa, golf, and each RV pad had its own outdoor barbecue entertainment center. Let's talk about those kind of parks. I mean, I could not believe. I mean, I almost want to live there. It looks so.
We've been to that one, Jim. We know the one you're talking about. We went there in our first year on the road, and it blew us away as well. They took us around in a golf cart, and some of these pads, I mean, they were selling for close to $500,000. I think they would have their own hot tub and outdoor patio, and a lot of those. If it's the one we're thinking of, it probably doesn't have a. It's got what's called on it a casita, which is basically like an extension of your RV. You can only be there when you have your RV, when you have your motorhome, and they usually have restrictions on the age and the size and sometimes even the brand of the motorhome to live there. It's kind of exclusive. But the facilities are incredible. It is like, it's like,
yeah, you can go extremely high-end luxurious resorts like that. And they are all across the country. We stayed at one this winter as well in Florida near Palm Beach area. Mm-hmm. And they are amazing properties. And a lot of them you buy into those. You can buy your property there. And some of them allow you to rent those out when you're not using them as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're really beautiful. I think anyone that thinks that you're roughing it in an RV needs to just look a little further. Because,
just have a look at those.
Yeah, they are really, there's some pretty fancy, beautiful places out there that, you know, really, really worth looking at.
Yeah, there's one in Newport Beach where you're actually right on the bay. So you have like oceanfront view. You could sail, you could water ski, whatever you want to do. Let me ask you this, because in the latest issue of RV Living, they had the concept of buying your own pad. So let's talk about this. Let's say either you're a snowbird, you live in Montana, North Dakota, or someplace where it's very cold, so you want to get out of town during the winter, or you're a sunbird, you live in Vegas or Phoenix, and you want to get out of the heat during the summer. Let's say you have found a spot that you just absolutely love. It's one of these resort parks that we talk about. What are the advantages of actually owning your own space, and how expensive can that be?
Well, you know what? We've been RVing for 5 years now, and we don't have a permanent space like that, but I absolutely see the draw to it and the value to it because, you know, like you were saying, it gives people a place to call home, a physical location that they feel grounded by having a place to return to. It also, you can help you build that community in that area, whether it's a sunbird or a snowbird location, like you said, a summer or winter. It also helps you establish domicile. It helps you stay in the real estate market, assuming you're expecting an increase in the value. It can often, as I mentioned a little bit ago, you can rent out those spaces when you're not using them, which helps offset the cost of it. It also ensures you have a place to stay because, you know, as you mentioned, a lot of people in the winter snowbirds, so their RVs become more geographically limited in the winter. They really can only stay in the very southern part of the U.S. And so spaces become at a premium. But conversely, in the summer, there's so many people who do vacationing in the summer that it can be crowded in the summer as well, even though they're not as geographically limited. So if you find a place that you really love, I would recommend considering buying a place. And it doesn't have to be expensive. We've seen lots that are, you know, a small investment and, you know, maybe only $10,000 to own in some of these lots. But we've seen other ones that are $200,000 and even $400,000. So it depends. But, you know, some of those high-end ones, if you really want to be able to choose the neighbors, I guess, and choose your community. But I would definitely recommend renting in one of those spaces for at least a week, if not longer, before investing in purchasing.
But you can also, there are many places you can do what's sort of seasonal or annual. So you don't even have to buy the lot. You can just, you know, lease it for the season. So it's not a commitment. It's more just like a long-term rental, basically. Mm-hmm. So we see that a lot as well. And that works really well for a lot of folks.
Yeah, because one of the things that I have heard from my own clients, because I have quite a few clients that have RVs, and that's the way they prefer to travel in retirement, they have said that, you know, unless you really plan well ahead, sometimes, you know, during the winter months, as you mentioned, you have to go south. There's limited space. And likewise, during summer vacation time, whether you're a sunbird or just somebody that wants to go on vacation, a lot of times it's hard to get in these parks because they're booked so well in advance.
Yeah, and a couple of points to that, Jim, is that especially if a lot of your clients, you know, do have more discerning taste, or maybe they are also boat or yacht owners as well, and they like being on the water or in those prime beach or marina locations, or in Florida for the winter, for example. I mean, even the fact that, you know, Florida is always popular in the winter, and there are more and more people RVing now, so that's just a lot more demand for that. But also, we lost 2,000 sites, RV sites in Florida after the hurricanes. So the available sites, so there's a lot of pressures on Florida in particular for reasons like that. But I think if you really want that peace of mind that, you know, I can go somewhere over a year, I've got a spot here for the 3 or 4 months over the winter, it's a really great way to go. It reduces a lot of distress because, you know, and even though it may seem you know, more expensive up front. If that peace of mind of just being able to settle in and relax, and then you're not spending as much on things like traveling around and fuel and all of that kind of a thing. But as Mike said earlier, the community's a big part of it. And we stayed at a Palm Beach Motor Coach Resort in Jupiter, Palm Beach area in Florida this winter. And it was just lovely. And there are 100 sites you can buy there, or you can rent, you know, try before you buy. And it was such a, we had a lovely time there. Fantastic location and so much to do in that area. So I think as RVing just becomes more and more popular. And the other thing, of course, as you and all of your audience would know, so many more people, the baby boomer generation, are retiring now at the rate of, I believe, is it 10,000 a day turning 65?
Yeah, 10,000 a day.
Yeah, that's a big number.
Big number. So you've got all of these, you've got more of those, and more of those are considering RVing as a way to enjoy their retirement years than just going and buying a condo in Florida. I'm sure you've seen the shift in that over the years as a much more younger and adventurous and fit and healthy people now, like, you know, what, 60s and new 50, right?
Yeah.
I think part of finding your locations, though, is, you know, being a little bit flexible as well. If you, like Julie said, if you want the prime spot, in, then you might want to be sure to have something booked ahead or have a seasonal rental. But, you know, if you're more flexible on where you're going to go, you can often find places to stay. And in fact, we just had 6 weeks where we didn't have any bookings in advance, and we were able to find places to stay. So it's not that you won't ever have anywhere. You just need to be a little bit more flexible and creative.
And I think personality part plays a part in that. You know?
Yeah.
We're experienced RVers, have been doing this a long time, and we're also set up to camp off-grid. So if for any reason we can't find a place, which has never happened actually, you know, we can always be off-grid with our solar and our battery set up. But I think for those that really like that peace of mind, getting a site, a permanent annual or buying your own lot is a fantastic option.
Yeah.
One of the things that I'm doing as I head into the RV life, I am going to be taking a driving course in Los Angeles for 2 days, because just like when I got into motoring, I took a navigation course, I took boat safety courses on how to sail. They have these same things in RV. In fact, let's talk about on your site, you have several classes that you teach, from RV Success Series 1 and 2, things for like planning trips. Talk about some of the courses that you offer, because you can drive the RV off the lot, but there's so many things you need to know, from planning a trip, tool supplies, how to provision your RV, rules of the road, other kinds of things. Let's talk about the courses you offer.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Well, I mean, I think the first starting point for anyone even considering the RV life is grab a copy of our book, Living the RV Life, Your Ultimate Guide to Life on the Road, because that in 9 chapters, we go into each of the main important areas that you need to think about before you enter into this lifestyle. So that's a really great way to be able to really learn all the things you need to know to get started. Obviously, not everything you need to know about RVing is in there or in our courses, because there's one thing we've learned as RVers is that you never, ever know everything, and you're always learning. But, you know, those that want to do a deeper dive, that's where our RV Success School comes in. And we've got a few courses there. One is called Hit the Road the Right Way. Another one is called Choosing the Right RV for You, which is very self-explanatory, and it goes much deeper into all of the important and, you know, more technical things that you really need to know and understand in making your RV purchasing decision. And not just the technical, but also, I mean, we've both got a coaching background, so we really take the approach of realizing that there's no one size fits all. And it's really about, you know, we're here to teach people to fish, not literally going fishing in the water, but, like, you know, rather than, you know, the saying, you can feed someone a fish or teach them how to fish. That's what we're here to do, is empower people with enough information and knowledge that they feel confident that they can make the right decision for them. And so we find a lot of people have been out there and, you know, done some research on blogs and YouTubes and read things, and that's all great. Wherever you can get knowledge from is great, but it's hard to know which information to trust, you know, what information is unbiased, you know, what is the source of that information. So I think that's what's really great about doing something like our RV Successful course, is that it's unbiased. And we don't just share from our own perspective. You mentioned RV Success Series 1 and 2. They are actually stories with other RVers that have done this and share from a range of different kinds of RV backgrounds, life stages, financial situations, and share in-depth interviews. And we dig down into the important questions about their thought processes and their planning process. But not only is our experience included in that, but that of many, many others. And so what's been wonderful about that is that people can watch those interviews, and they usually go for 40 minutes to an hour each, these video interviews, is you can find people that you relate to or certain situations or circumstances. And so it takes all of that sea of information that's out there, because we live in a world of information overload, and we really aim to make it more clear and concise and be able to help cut through that so people have an actual roadmap to help them hit the road with clarity and confidence. And feedback that we get from our students, you know, the best way to do it really is to buy the bundle. That's the most economical way. And if somebody wants one-on-one coaching, we do that too. But we always say start with the book. If you want to do a deeper dive, get into the courses. And then if you want a one-on-one, then we can, it's a great way to do your due diligence before you make big life changes and big expensive purchases and decisions. And that's proved to work really well.
And finally, would you recommend what I'm going to do, which is basically take a two-day course on driving, what you need to know in terms of handling an RV on the road, whether it's parking in a RV park or it is actually driving on a freeway?
Oh, I would absolutely. I'm so happy to hear you're doing that. And I would highly recommend that to anyone who doesn't have any experience driving larger vehicles. I had a bit of an advantage over the average population in that I had driven super stretch limousines and some large trucks in my previous career before I got into RVing. And so I was more comfortable with that to start with. But most people just aren't used to driving these, whether it be a motorhome and towing a car, or if it's a truck and trailer. And that can be a really big factor in increasing your enjoyment and reducing the risk of causing injury to yourself or to others, and or damage to your RV. We've had people who didn't get enough practice and then made some errors that really took a lot of the joy out of their lifestyle when they
can be expensive in terms of time and money. But,
yeah, because they are different to drive. They're taller, they're wider. There's things like tail swing in that the back of the RV can swing out more than you expect it to with a regular car. There's a lot of little factors that having some professional guidance will dramatically increase your enjoyment.
And I would add to that, you know, the ladies as well, and Jim, I don't know if you're traveling solo or if you're taking your wife with you, really great for both parties. Even if one of you isn't planning to drive, it's just really great to have that peace of mind. And I have not done an RV driving course myself, I will admit, and that is definitely on my wish list. But I don't do the driving presently, but I've met a lot of women who were really intimidated and came away from that and drive off at a 45-foot motorhome just like a boss.
Yeah, well, and it's an interesting point too that sometimes you might find when you travel with your partner that one person might be better at parking than the other. And so don't be afraid to explore the options. You know, when you're trying to park this big rig, one person might be better at guiding the person behind the wheel being outside of the RV than the person actually steering it and have the other person guiding. So if you can redefine those roles, you may find something you didn't expect.
We know a lot of RVs, you know, the majority of the time the husband, you know, for example, will drive, but very often, you know, the wife is the primary driver in a lot of the rigs. But, you know, we meet a lot of a lot of solo RVs as well, and a lot of ladies that actually rock it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got a client who they, for a number of years, towed a fifth wheel. But, you know, unfortunately, the husband developed Parkinson's, so they got rid of the fifth wheel, got a smaller A-class, and the wife is the one that does the driving now.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
You see that a lot.
Yeah, you see a lot of people mixing up how they travel. And, you know, again, even sharing the driving load, whether it's different parts of the drive or if they both do a lot of this, just sharing it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, listen, Mark and Julie, thanks for coming back on the program. And, you know, if you really want to get into this and really learn, I highly recommend Mark and Julie's book. It's called Living the RV Life, Your Ultimate Guide to the Life on the Road. And if you want to take it beyond that, they have a lot of courses on their site called RVLove.com. So once again, the name of the book, Living the RV Life, Your Ultimate Guide to the Life on the Road, and RVLove.com, the website. Mark and Julie, thanks so much for joining us, and happy RVing.
Thank you
so much. Jim. Thank you.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye now.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.